Please support the Climate Change and Happiness podcast. See the donate page at climatechangeandhappiness.com.
Welcome to Climate Change and Happiness, an international podcast that explores the personal side of climate change, your feelings, what the crisis means to you, and how to cope and thrive. And now, your hosts, Thomas Doherty and Panu Pikkala.
Well, hello, I'm Thomas Doherty.
And I am Panu Pikkala.
And welcome to Climate Change and Happiness. This is our podcast, the show for people around the globe who are thinking and feeling deeply and creatively about climate change and other environmental issues and, you know, all the things that we think about, the big issues in the world that we're concerned about and how we want the world to be, and then our own private lives and our own individual thoughts and feelings and our individual days. And so this is a place where we reflect on all of that and have asked the provocative question, what does it mean to be happy in the modern world? So we're talking about the arts today. We're talking about art, and that includes music and books and literature and painting and very complicated high arts, and also pop culture and songs we hear on the radio and things that come through us through YouTube and all that kind of stuff. So Panu, let's get going. What are your initial thoughts on this art? Why are we talking about art today?
Always a pleasure to discuss the arts. And in Finnish language, there's a word called taide for the arts, and viihde is entertainment. And there's a long-standing discussion about what's the exact relation between taide and viihde, so art and entertainment. And I'm sort of siding with those who think that the borders are not so strict, and it's a sort of contextual thing that works of creativity, which are perhaps aimed mainly for entertainment, may give people that kind of impacts and fruits, which are more discussed in, for example, research about art. So that's for one framing related thing I have on my mind. And when we come to the topics of climate change and the ecological crisis, there's the distinction between art, using the term broadly, which explicitly discusses environmental themes in some way, or comments on eco-emotions, for example. And then there's artworks which, to begin with, don't have any explicit connection, but still engaging with them has some kind of important impacts for the ability to live amidst environmental changes.
Yeah.
And for me, I've been engaging with both kinds, but the latter one, just art with no explicit link, that's been actually more important for me in the last months.
Yeah. Yeah, just while we're jumping into this, you are one of the many facets of this is that you've been working with dancers, right? And either a modern dance or a ballet company in Finland that's been doing some dance productions related to climate?
Yeah, that's been a fascinating project, and lately also starting to experiment more with dance movement myself, not on stage. And that's, I so far just keep the stage for speaking and sometimes music, but not for dancing. But this cooperation with choreographer, director Ninni Perko and the Sivun Ensemble was a performance called Silentopia, which we probably have mentioned in the podcast. So that was explicitly about encountering our emotions about the state of the world and environment. And I learned a lot while participating and watching the development of that one. But then there's also a network of people in the Helsinki area, and we are sort of experimenting with various methods related to dance and movement. So for example, just different environments on places and then using movement. So I've been learning from others in that regard also.
Yeah, it's so fascinating. I was just thinking about our previous episodes, We had met with Scott Ordway, who was a composer who had written a very powerful music and choral and spoken word piece about the forest fires and wildfires in California. Two of our former podcast guests, as it happens, Erica Berry and Daniela Molnar, Erica Berry being a creative nonfiction writer who wrote the book Wolfish about women and nature and wolves and women's fear of nature. And then Daniela Molnar, who's a poet and a kind of a visual artist and painter who does her own natural pigments and does art based in glaciers and climate change. Both Erica and Daniela won awards in Oregon for the Oregon Book Awards this just recently. Daniela for poetry and Erica for nonfiction. So there's just so many directions. You know, I mean, when we say the word the arts, it sounds kind of official, but that's meaning like really, you know, people that are professional artists, composers, poets, painters, and then, you know, entertainment, I think, is where we get into music, like pop music and rock music and things like that, or TV shows or movies. But yeah, it's just so much a part of our, I think why it's important to me is because it's so much a part of our life. This idea of our environmental identity and our beliefs and values and sense of ourself and nature and the natural world, so much of it is translated through art, you know, through movies and books and TV shows and pop culture, TikTok, you know, influencers, all that kind of stuff. So the art of survival. So like even surviving in the world, there's an art to it. Like we can do it with class and with grace and with style. Yeah, it's really interesting. And then anything artistic is great because we can go in 360 degrees in terms of emotions, right? So it's like some of the music on my climate playlist is really dark and kind of cathartic. Others of it is really light and celebratory. Some of it helps me to have meaning when I hear someone else talking about their problems, and it's energizing. It's really, really interesting. Yeah. What else? What kind of art, music, either high art or pop culture art has been sort of influencing you and being part of your health lately?
Building a bridge from our climate emotions playlists, those earlier episodes, the Canadian post-rock band Godspeed You Black Emperor visited Finland, and I was able to go to a concert by them in the city of Tampere. So that was very interesting, immersive experience, and a very, I think, profound way to connect with many emotions, but also in a complex way. It's not obvious what emotions exactly a lengthy post-rock song or composition is conveying. I think there are certain sort of major themes and major emotional landscapes in certain songs, but still there's lots of variability between how people hear and experience those. So, and that genre in general, post-rock, continues to be very important for me. And one aspect is that it doesn't have lyrics. I really appreciate powerful and many kinds of song lyrics, but sometimes it's very nice to just be in relation with the music without the words. And often after a work day, having dealt with many words and sometimes listening to people's worries, even though that's a much smaller part of my work life than yours, Thomas. It's very nice to just to listen to post-rock or classical or sometimes ambient and leave the words aside for a while.
Yeah. Godspeed You Black Emperor is a very band that only certain people would know about. But while I was looking at their website while we were talking, you know, Godspeed You Black Emperor has released a string of albums from 1997 to 2002, widely recognized as redefining what protest music can be, where long-form instrumental chamber rock compositions of immense feeling and power serve as soundtracks to late capitalist alienation and resistance. yeah, and you know, that's it. They're, you know, they're using art to, in their mind, be explicitly political. And so that's part, that, that's part of it there. So we'll put a link to some of their compositions, but it is, it is what they call post-rock in the sense of it's using rock and roll instrumentation along with other multimedia and classical, you know, kind of avant-garde styles of music.
Yeah, and various kinds of imagery during the concerts, and that imagery might be just from nature or the modern human world, or it might be from civil demonstrations and unrest, so there's a wide range. Mm-hmm. And sometimes there's a certain politicality, even though they don't have sermons on the on the gigs, but it's present. But what about you, Thomas? What are some of the artworks which have inspired or intrigued you lately?
Well, there's a lot. You know, a movie that a number of my eco-psychology colleagues have recommended that I had not seen was the movie First Reformed, starring Ethan Hawke and directed by it's Paul Schrader, I believe. And it's a very, I happened to watch it just recently, actually in preparation for our conversation today, because I wanted to see what the hype was about there. And you know, it is a great example of a very challenging movie. It's not a typical Hollywood movie. It's much more symbolic and enigmatic, and you know, you have to watch it and kind of make sense of it. But it explicitly talks about the depths of despair and loss that come in the modern world around war and environmental catastrophe, and the actual story is about a minister who's confronted with a young couple who are about to have a child, and they're really scared and ambivalent about bringing a child into the world, and one of the parents is really really deep into despair around the environmental catastrophes around the world. So it plunges us deeply into that, and the characters all struggle. And the minister, of course, is dealing with his own grief because his son has died and his life has kind of been upended, and what he thought he believed, and his marriage is lost. And he's also drinking too much and not healthy and has a health condition. So it's a very dark movie that'll drag you through the depths, but it can be read very symbolically. The minister standing in for people that are, you know, really struggling to make sense and meaning, and he's polluting his own body with his drinking and ignoring his health concerns and not seeing a doctor. So he kind of stands for society that's not really dealing with problems. And then, of course, the young people seeking some solace, and the priest not really having much to say about them. But then the priest, of course, goes into his own sort of eco despair, and there's a overlap between the war that Iraq war that his son died in, and people that are doing eco protests and potentially eco sabotage, and then of course it's overlaid with Christianity and all of that kind of stuff too. A lot of Christian imagery and lack of connection with God, and just basic spirituality. The books that he's reading are all about kind of how it's difficult to actually know the mind of God, and from a Christian standpoint. So it's a very in-depth movie, but watching it is a way to kind of exercise a lot of the demons, I think, that people are feeling around all this sort of stuff. And there's no easy answers. The movie leaves you guessing and thinking about what does it mean, and I guess that's the point. That's the point of some of movies. It's not meant to be easy. Mm-hmm. And of course, that director, Paul Schrader, has done other powerful movies, and this movie almost is reminiscent of the movie Taxi Driver from the early 70s, which was another alienated character, you know, cut off from society that was flirting with or became violent. So there's a weird kind of juxtaposition between Taxi Driver and this movie. So anyway, fascinating.
Yeah, thanks for dwelling on that. And I've had in mind to watch it for a long time, and it's in many ways so relevant to things in my life history, also my history with Christianity and the eco-anxiety stuff. And it's one of the first explicit movies about ecological distress or despair, I think, coming out in 2018. Of course, there's been depictions of worry and despair about environmental damage in movies before, but it's a major theme in First Reformed, and it's theologically a very civilized movie, also a deep movie. So it's a commentary on quite fundamental questions around despair and hope and knowing or unknowing, as you hinted at Thomas. So I was very struck and impressed with it, and perhaps watching with a group of trusted people might be a safe method to engage with it. And it was also strongly connected with something I've just been writing, finishing an academic article about spirituality and coping with ecological grief. And there was a profound array of connections between that and the movie, because when people are dealing with difficult issues, which is part of life, then spirituality and religion, they might be very important resources for people, giving strength, and one might find support from others in some kind of spiritual community. Or there may be also contradictions and challenges. For example, when the members of your spiritual community are not able to understand or support you in your grief. And there's been interesting research about that from a general perspective, and now I was exploring it in the context of ecological grief. And so that resonated a lot in my mind when watching First Reformed.
Yeah, and I know Climate Psychology Alliance has done some movie nights, and it's a tradition among some therapy groups to use art and movies as a way to think about therapy and mental health. And so that First Reformed is not a light movie to take on. It's a challenging one, but it is worth it. It is worth it to look at. And I think the key with a lot of this is struggling to put it into words, but to bring it back to just our own coping, and just for the listeners, you know, a lot of these art movies are meant to make us think, and the artist, whether it's a singer or a writer or a painter, they create something that's meant to communicate a lot of things, and it's meant to make us think. It's kind of like dealing with dreams. Like, I've had some different dreams lately, and some more troubling dreams. And I know enough to not take my dreams too seriously in the sense of reading them just literally, but realize that the dreams they symbolize different things. And so kind of being, kind of not getting sucked into really sad songs or really sad music or even really sad news, we're realizing there's more to it, and it's not just the surface that I'm reacting to. Like, there's more to it, and reminding yourself this is an art. We can lose ourselves in a movie and get depressed, but we have to remind ourselves this is an art. This isn't real. It's an artistic experience that I'm choosing to take on. I'm choosing to do this, so it's really like it is something that's kind of like an entertainment, but just not taking it literally, I think, is important. Because if we don't do that, our body just takes in the danger with a lot of the art or music is that our body just takes in just even more stress and more angst and more negative and dark stuff. So we also have to have some choice about what we're taking in. That's the shadow side, right? Like, we're just confronted with all this news and information, and we just take it in. You know, or just be, you know, I guess it's not being just a consumer of this, passive consumer of all this imagery, but being more of an active creative, having our own creativity about what we take into our psyche. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it certainly does. And the metaphor of a diet is here relevant also, something which we have been discussing in many episodes. So not too one-sided. And for me, it works so that sometimes I engage with more serious and potentially sadness-producing works of art, so which cause us to think and feel, and sometimes those feelings evoked by art may be difficult to articulate, and that's part of the richness also. So not, even though generally it's very useful to practice ability to name emotions and feelings, but sometimes it's also just good just to feel complex array of emotions and feelings, and we don't have to be able to name them all the time, and works of art can give a framing in which to do that. And then sometimes I focus on very light and joyful stuff. So there's the Ingmar Bergman art movies, which also came into mind when watching First Remote, and then there's collections of different songs and performances from The Voice in program in various countries. So that's part of my weekly diet, those ones too. And in so-called emotion-focused therapy, they are using the concepts of upregulating and or downregulating emotion, and in other frameworks also. So I've been thinking about that over the spring also, and different ways in which we could upregulate various kinds of climate emotions also, sometimes sadness and sometimes joy. And part of that is being able to recognize what sort of regulation we have to do as part of our daily lives. For example, often we have to downregulate the sadness because the news can be so grim during the day. So finding a balance, also realizing that what I had to downregulate or suppress during the day, and what would be an important counterpart or counterforce for that in the evening.
Yeah.
For some people, it might be engaging with sadness and then engaging with something empowering. But what's your thoughts on that, Thomas? I know you have been thinking about this a lot. So.
No, it's super helpful to think about it as, how do we want to, like, if our arts are entertainment, is a diet, and we're doing it to be healthy, do we want to upregulate or downregulate? Do I want to watch something that's lighthearted and uplifting that helps me relax and tap into my health and my values, or do I want to challenge myself with taking on challenging music or art? That's really helpful. I mean, another big part of it is, am I doing it with someone or not? Because a lot of, it's one thing to watch a movie like First Reformed by yourself, sitting in a lonely room. And you might choose to do that, just like you'd read a novel or something. But it's also another thing to watch it with a group of people. Then it becomes a social event, and it's easier to bear difficult stuff with other people. So, so it's not only the art, but how we take it in, like we choosing to do it. I mean, for me, because I'm very busy and a solo parent, it's a reward for me. It's a special thing for me to be able to sit and watch a movie or listen to something. I don't just have time passively to take all this in. So I couldn't be a consumer even if I wanted to, because I'm too have too many things going on. So we can basically use different artistic things about climate change and environmental issues to help us cope with climate change and environmental issues, and really take us in different directions, either bearing witness, like the First Reformed is a real bearing witness kind of thing, where really so we're going to stand for this and we're going to look clearly at it. But, listening to some upbeat music or cathartic music is a different kind of thing. Coming back to this idea of entertainment versus art, that I think is a neat distinction, partly because, I think some art doesn't need to be heavy and it doesn't need to be too intellectual. It's not like you're in a class where you're going to write a paper about something. You know, it's okay to be entertained, but there's something sinister I think we have to be careful with in our culture about just a lot of the entertainment that's created is really nihilistic and really kind of just, I don't know, violent and depressing. And, you know, we have to be careful about just a steady diet of that. And then there's this weird, mixture of entertainment and news that we have now in our culture too, where some news shows are really comedies, you know, like the Daily Show or something like that. So it's like, is it entertainment? Is it news? And so it's all mixed up. And some of the actual physical real news is so absurd and so bizarre. And then of course we have entertainers and various celebrities that are in fact political leaders. So it's a spectacle. So it really is, there's something about turning it off, just turn it all off, unplug. Let's chat about that for a second. Like,
The culture of the spectacle is very relevant, I think. And it would be marvelous if we could find enough resources to challenge ourselves regularly enough with works of art, which we may not have the energy to do every day or every week, but at least regularly. And having a history of going to movie theaters, that's also a difference between contemporary habits of watching visuals and the old ways. And if you go to a movie theater and you have paid the tickets, if you are for 20 minutes wondering that do I really like this movie or not, you are probably still not leaving because you have paid the ticket. And sometimes, you know, I've been very surprised after I have stayed and watched it that, hey, this was actually much more profound than I thought it would be after the first 20 minutes, not always, but still. So what I'm after is that it would be very good if we could give ourselves chance is to be surprised and not to be overly bored with slowly developing things. So that's of course a big change in the contemporary visual feed, that the tempo is so fast. And there again, I think variation between tempo would be very, very important.
Yeah, exactly. So importance of unplugging and being more assertive about what we're taking in, our diet of information. And so that brings us to this idea of digital versus analog. That's another distinction. You know, it's one thing for me to put on headphones and listen to some music. It's another thing to me for it to actually play music myself, you know, go in my garage and play music on my drums or play music with someone, something that's hands-on. So it doesn't matter what the art is. It could be drawing, could be writing, could be music, could be, you know, we have a nice theater culture in Portland, Oregon, where I live, where you can go see live theater in a space where people are just you know, creating these works as humans have done for thousands of years with no microphones and no, you know, just real human art. And seeing live music, live bands of various kinds, having art in our own life in terms of how we decorate our spaces and how we dress and how we eat, all that kind of stuff. So I think, you know, so ultimately it becomes a kind of sustainability and a kind of ecology. You know, that's another way to think about this. It comes back to some of our deepest values about, you know, balance and ecology and health and things like that. So watching a nature show on public television versus actually going into a park and watching birds, you know, and all that kind of thing.
The ecology of art and art of ecology.
Yeah. Sort of thing. Yeah, it came up, I can't remember now, I think it was in my, it was in my therapy training group where I work with therapists. We were talking about nature, and I'll put a link to it. It's an artist that does artistic projects. It's complicated, a little tangent here at the end of our episode, but I think it's a way to sum up a little bit as well. This is an artist and a documentary photographer who has done a whole artistic program around roadkill, which is animals that have been killed on the side of the road. And she creates art, which are small memorials to the animals, but very beautifully done memorials to the actual dead animal that's on the side of the road. And this is not a new idea. People have done this before. Barry Lopez wrote about this years ago, but I'll put a link to it, but they're incredibly beautiful, ephemeral, natural art installations that she would create around an animal that has been killed using stones and leaves and feathers and things like that. But it's very hands-on, and it's a form of art, and it's also a form of bearing witness and a form of grieving. So it's a great example of when this comes together well, it can be super powerful.
Yeah, and once again, points to the close connections between arts and ritual also. So.
Yeah.
And also connecting with the broad theme of spirituality, especially if we define it as having a relationship with something larger than yourself, or some kind of dimension of depth in our lives. So
yeah,
a lot to continue discussing about in future episodes.
Also. Yeah, yeah. So the artist is called Amanda Stronza, Stronza, and we'll put a link to her work. But just an example of where the conversation goes with arts, entertainment, music, pop culture. So it's where you swim in a sea of it. So it's something to be aware of in our personal sustainability, in our climate change and happiness lifestyle. So Panu, thanks for the chat, as always, and listeners, send us a message, you can find us at, info@climatechangeandhappiness.com, and just send us a message what you think about what's going on for you. We'd appreciate hearing from you. Connor, you have a good rest of your evening, and listeners, be well.
Take care.
The Climate Change and Happiness podcast is a self-funded volunteer effort. Please support us so we can keep bringing you messages of coping and thriving. See the donate page at climatechangeandhappiness.com.